Medic one inbound to your facility. Emergency traffic on a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds. CPR in progress. Patient intubation. IO in place. We will be here in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff podcast, your source for all things EMS. Today, we have kind of a weird episode. We're just two of us again. I was down last episode. David is down this episode, so it's really just me and Bradley Dean. We're going to be discussing some, I think, a pretty awesome topic to discuss because it's nothing that really comes up in school. It's something that we really don't talk about too often, even after the fact until something bad happens. But before we get started into all that, I figured I'd just ask Bradley, see how his weekend has been going since the weather's been changing and all that fun stuff.
Lots of sun, but lots of rain. It was a rather dismal weekend off and on. But, I'm not going to say it was bad because it was a good weekend and I was able to get out in it just a little bit.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I was able to do the same thing. We had our kids. I didn't realize how much time kids' sports takes. This is our first year doing organized sports with our kids, and it's been interesting. My daughter, I think they accidentally ended up in the championship. We were all kind of surprised, like, holy crap, they won. Okay, and then they won second. But yeah, it's been a lot hotter here. It was supposed to rain, no rain, so been good for getting out in the garden and stuff like that. Irish people like me don't do very well in the sun. We kind of like the fall.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because, David's not with us because he got sunburned. Mm-hmm. I think he took his daughter to college or something like that and then got out in the sun. And he was afraid he'd be a little red.
I'm a veteran of having first and like second degree burns on me. So I can tell you that stuff just wears you out. I'm so vigilant about it now. I get my kids all sorts of sunblock and stuff now. It's just a horrible, horrible existence to get sunburned. Well, awesome. Well, before we get started on this, we have to go through and thank our awesome sponsors, Gyms. Remember, Gyms is also your source for all things EMS. They put on our podcast, but you won't find our podcast if you're searching for it on Apple, iTunes, or anything like that. You have to actually go to the Gyms. You have to look it up in Gyms to find our podcast. It's the EMS Handoff. You can also check out all the other podcasts that they have available, and hopefully they're doing the same for us. I don't know if they are or not. Probably ought to listen and see if they're giving us a shout out as well. Have you heard any of? I haven't heard any.
I haven't heard any of them do it, but I certainly hope they do because I point a lot of people to the various ones that are there.
Man, maybe we should cross-pollinate. They should come on our show one time. We'll go on theirs, and then we can hit two birds with one stone. We all get to share in on that. The other thing we want to make sure that you're aware of is we have a line of awesome gear at Pursue Outfitters. You can find that by going to pursueoutfitters.com. If you click under, you'll see, I can't remember what the name of the thing is, but you'll be able to find EMS Handoff. We have a new t-shirt that David Blevins actually was wearing. I think he had a picture of it on our Facebook group, which, speaking of Facebook group, make sure you follow us on Facebook, like us, leave some comments. That helps us out. Quite frankly, helps us social engineer our way into everybody's feeds. So you're getting this and, hey, not politics. That's nice. You can get EMS Handoff and not politics. So that's a great thing. Why don't you do that? Or go on YouTube. Like us on YouTube. That would be awesome. Like us, subscribe to us, hit the little bell thingy. It's the same thing everybody says. Make sure you're doing that, though. And don't forget to check out our gear, Pursue Outfitters. I'm wearing mine right now. I like my T-shirts. They're really nice. I need to buy more of them. I need to get the red one. I feel like the red one is like our thing. We need to make the red one our color, you know?
I almost put the red one on.
I was thinking about that. I was like, I want to get another shirt, but I'm tired of wearing black or blue or something. I need to wear something that's a little more out there. And I have tennis shoes that will match the red. So I'm probably going to get the red one next. And then, like I said, it's really comfortable. I know everybody's out there with gear. I got it. But this is really nice stuff. And it's a local company. You're not, this isn't being farmed out to some big service somewhere. This is a local company. So you're supporting a local company by supporting that. And you're supporting us and incentivizing us to continue doing these podcasts. All right. So without further ado, let's have you, Bradley. I think you can introduce the, I guess I would say more of a somber topic that we're going to be discussing tonight. If you want to go ahead.
So this all started because I was walking through. So my office has a little garden. So we have the agriculture extension that is right beside of our office. And there's a little garden there. So last week I was walking around and I found some butterflies, and those butterflies reminded me pretty much of, I guess you could say, our life. So their life starts off as a caterpillar. So they go through their life, they eat a lot, and then they, you know, spin this cocoon, and then they emerge as beautiful butterflies. Well, for whatever reason, that caused me to have this little epiphany of it. That's our life. So we go through life, we eat, we do this whole thing, we have our little cocoon, and then all of a sudden we emerge as these butterflies. Well, butterflies live, but for a very, very short time. So I was sitting there and I was thinking, you know, imagine a society in which patients are routinely euthanized. You know, whether they want their lives to end or not, if their suffering cannot be alleviated without dulling their consciousness, eliminating their independence or threatening their dignity. In such a society, you know, defenders of the status quo might argue that the duty to prevent suffering and indignity makes the policy imperative. Well, a compelling response would be that while suffering, indignity, and loss of independence are undesirable, only the person enduring them should decide whether they are unbearable or not. So if a patient is competent to decide, nobody other than that patient should have the authority to decide whether life is worth continuing. So the very same argument can be advanced against the current practice, you know, prevalent in most countries or prohibiting people from seeking assistance to end their lives. Well, we really can't do that. Although some people might decide that suffering and indignity that characterize their lives are not sufficiently bad enough or not worth continuing. While other people say, well, you know, that is that condition, whatever they're suffering, is unbearable. So just as it would be wrong to force people to die, so many people to endure conditions that they find to be unbearable. Well, when we look at that, we encounter patients all the time that have incurable diseases. And their first rule in medicine is do no harm. And sometimes I wonder and question whether a decision about to continue living in such condition is something we should make, or is that something the patient should make? Because for years, we have had the ability for patients to sign do not resuscitate orders, for them and their physician to make them do not resuscitate patients. But are we doing patients that don't have DNR orders justice?
That's a good thought, because I think it's a topic that's like, it's going to be controversial, because you're looking at ethical, philosophical, religious, and all that, and all these different things. It's also uncomfortable. That's not something that we really talk about. We talk about the black and the white legal framework of a patient case study. And we're going to talk about some that are pretty, they're kind of black and white, but we're talking about the gray areas. And I think we're in a unique position in EMS, because we get to see these challenges up front and center. And we're making split second decisions a lot of time as to like, what am I going to do for this person? And I think we have a greater appreciation of the gravity of that since the beginning of the pandemic. When, you know, and that just kind of seasons this, that kind of puts a little bit more boldness into this conversation. Because, I mean, before we might have had our own idea of what suffering and stuff means and delaying care or not doing the same level of care that we would do typically. And then all of a sudden COVID hit and people didn't have a choice anymore. It was like, no, we have limited, constrained resources. There are decisions that are being made because we're having to conserve as many resources as possible for those decisions. But I like where this is going. And first off here, I just want to say, if there are people who are listening to this and they're on, you know, Facebook or YouTube, and you want to sound off in the comments, you're right. I hope you do. I really want this to engage with, use this to engage with your students or whatever. But I bet Wes would probably appreciate if we at least said, make sure you follow your local protocol at any point.
But and this whole thing comes up because, you know, whether the person's got, you know, an incurable disease or you're faced with, you know, end of life decisions, unfortunately, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit here. Today we had a memorial for one of our local law enforcement officers who was a significant other of one of our paramedics. Unfortunately, he died due to complications from COVID-19. And, you know, several weeks ago, he went on the ventilator. We knew things were not good. And we knew that eventually, you know, decisions were going to have to be made. Things were going to have to happen. But, you know, going back to this whole topic of, you know, just as it's wrong to force people to die, it's also wrong to force people to endure conditions that they find unbearable.
And you know what? That actually is a good point. And I think a lot of that, too, is grounded in the expectations that civilians and people who are not medicine have for medicine. Like, they literally think we're miracle workers. That, like, yes, I know the doctor said that that they have this incurable congestive heart failure or whatever it is, but I know you guys can do something for it, not realizing that most of what we're going to do is a Band-Aid. It's so temporary. And all we're doing is prolonging the inevitable and prolonging and living many times suffering, because that's what they do. They don't have a clue. And a lot of times they're not educated on this properly. I mean, think about it. We live in a society where if you have high blood pressure, don't change your lifestyle. Just go get the pills. And then that's not to get, I'm not trying to trivialize hypertension or things like that, but I'm saying, like, we've kind of created this mental model for medical decisions, and it's usually based around interventions and drugs and stuff. So of course people are going to think, oh, you know, yeah, they don't have a right to die, but we don't have to make them. We can make them really comfortable. There's other stuff that we can do, not realizing actually there's physical limitations of what we're allowed to do too.
Right. And so looking at that, we can take away the pain. We can take away the suffering. As far as the mind is concerned, the person doesn't really know. Or we can make their body not really care. The rest of their body, though, continues to suffer throughout the process. We can make them not understand. We can make them not care. We can take away the pain, but the rest of their body has to fight, you know, any subsequent infection, any subsequent muscle deterioration, any further breakdown that the body is going to take. And I don't think some people really understand that sometimes the right thing to do is to allow the natural process to take over.
Oh yeah. I know we're going to get into this. So I guess we could start making our way. You know what? I'll save it, because I know that my example is a good example for later on in what we're going to discuss. So we can start going through some of those. Cause the first point you talk about, and I really like this, is that right to die versus the right to live. And that's pretty much what we've been discussing, though, this entire time. It's like, yeah, you have a right to die, or you have a right to live, absolutely. But we also live in a developed country with developed technologies, developed medicine, developed everything. We also have a privilege to be able to make a lot of decisions that many people around the world do not have. And so, especially in desperate part of the countries where we just don't have, either we have lack of resources or we have plenty of resources to help make these decisions. It's kind of a weird scenario.
Right. And so let's take ourselves out of the pandemic situation, out of the lack of resources for a minute. And, you know, under most circumstances, we have the ability to relieve the pain and suffering while the natural process takes over. You know, so the decision about whether to continue living in such condition is among the most important that can be made. Just as people value having control over whether to live, you know, which occupation they want to pursue, who they want to marry, whether they want to have children, you know, so people have control over whether, you know, they want to continue to live as their quality of life deteriorates. So, you know, that is why the right to life, the right to die are not two rights, but two aspects or descriptions of the same right. So don't view it as opposing sides. View it as the same thing. So the right to life is the right to decide whether one will continue living. And the right to die is the right to decide whether one, you know, will die, you know, when they could continue living. But if the right to life were only a right to decide to continue living and didn't also include a right to decide not to continue living, then it would be a duty to live rather than a right to live. And the idea that there is a duty to continue living, regardless of how bad life has become, is really implausible. So individuals should have the right to decide which path they're going to take based upon an incurable or something that's no longer going to sustain life, I guess would be the best way to say it.
Yeah. Kind of like they need to have good discussions. This isn't like a flippant decision that's made, off the cuff. Because they're feeling bad or something. These are decisions that are made programmatically with healthcare providers and stuff. This isn't something that's like, you know, made on a scene specifically, you know, in certain situations there are rare ones out there, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
So, I mean, you know, short of traumatic incidents where a patient has, you know, injuries that are not consistent with life. These are decisions when they get diagnosed with an incurable disease that really should take, I would say, 15 to 30 days. They should be having these conversations, you know, alongside of, you know, what treatments and things that they want. So most places, and we'll get into a little bit of legalities in a minute, and to kind of give everybody a background. So this is part of what I did in grad school. Was looking at, you know, ethical aspects of treatment and everything else. So when you look at it, you know, people say, well, you know, take 24 hours or go sleep on your decision. Well, really, these are decisions that families and individuals should have for a minimum, I would say, of 2 weeks, 15 days to 30 days as they really walk through. What are their options? What can I do? What can the specialist refer me to? Because, you know, I have seen patients with stage 4 cancer live for years. And sometimes they live with a little bit of pain until the very end, and there's a lot of pain. And I've seen them live with, you know, weeks to a couple of months.
I was thinking about this too while you were talking, like the decisions, like I always thought, yeah, sleep on it. I think that's good advice for writing an email. You get an email that's bad, you know what, wait 24 hours and then write your email. That same concept should not be to what kind of legal document you're signing over. These are discussions that quite frankly, the earlier you have them and kind of like get wishes out on paper, the more peace the family will be. Sadly, I had a dear close friend of mine. He passed away from COVID a few weeks ago. And I remember going up to the hospital because we had to sign as a witness to his last will and testimony. And I was thinking, he's in a good situation, or in the best legal situation for his family to have this opportunity, that he had all this stuff already written down. He just needs some people to come sign it. And a lot of times when we don't think of something like that, like a really bad diagnosis, and we just kind of like have the ostrich theory, head in the sand, let's use hope, because I think people would shift hope into despair if they think that they have to start considering legal stuff. That's why they don't want to do it. It's almost like a stage of grief, which is that kind of denial. Like, it's fine. I mean, like, you could be diagnosed with cancer or CHF or something like that and still have a plan and still get through it. And then you don't need to use the plan. Well, that's great. You didn't have to use the plan, but it's nice to have that for everybody else involved who's going to be left behind.
You know, right. And the whole legal thing, you know, we're talking about different things. We'll get into advanced directives and DNRs and everything else in a minute. But, you know, you're talking about living will. You know, for example, you know, I have a living will because of some medical things. And then, you know, previously with the Army, you know, I had a living will. Well, unfortunately, due to life circumstances and everything else, within the last couple of weeks, you know, my divorce was finalized. Well, the problem is the person that was appointed to take care of that was my ex. So now I need to go redo all that. Mm-hmm. I can't leave my head in the sand and expect my two daughters that, you know, my daughters live with me, you know, both of them are under the age of 18. Well, they're not going to be able to make those decisions. So I now have to default and relook at, you know, all of my legal stuff. So as EMS providers, we've got to make sure that we look at that, not just for our families, but for, you know, everything else. So let's spin this and look at a couple of pivotal cases in the history of, you know, the right to die, I guess, as we should call it. So Karen Ann Quinlan was born in March 29th of 1954. And for those of you that saw the teaser on YouTube, you know, we talked a little bit about that. And that teaser came out on June 11th. Well, June 11th, 1985 was when she died. And she was a real instrumental figure in the right to die controversy in the United States. When she was 21, she became unconscious after consuming a large amount of Valium and alcohol while on a crash diet, and she lapsed into a coma. So it was late 1977, a little movie came out called In the Matter of Karen Ann Quinlan. And if you go back and you watch that movie, it shows her father, you know, holding on to all hope and everything else. And the physicians were trying to tell him that, you know, look, you know, we've done all this, you know, what you're looking at is things that, you know, you're holding on to a memory of what used to be, not what is. And eventually the parents were at a point of, hey, let's take her off the ventilator. But there was a lot of controversy surrounding that. So they took her off the ventilator. They put in a PEG tube, and she remained on that PEG tube until she eventually died in 1985 with her mother by her side. So became a very pivotal case. If you want to look at it, you can Google it. You can read all the legal documents on it. And they really established the whole piece of comfort care. And that's where I really think that's where hospice kind of got its spin up. And hospice, you know, for a long time was just for people who were last stages of life. Now hospice does all kinds of things, from mm-hmm. from comfort care to bridging the gap to everything else. But if you look up Karen Ann Quinlan Hospice in New Jersey and the different branches they have up through there, wonderful program and process, and, you know, lots of education out there about hospice. I don't know what your...
Yeah. Her parents actually set up a memorial hospice, I believe, for her too. That case was interesting because it actually forced, I think it was hospitals and nursing homes and stuff, to create ethical committees and stuff Yeah. I mean, this was a big deal. This wasn't just some one-off case. And yeah, I'm with you about the hospice, like we used to think of, and some people may actually still have that consideration for hospice. Oh, that's for people who are passing away. It's like, not really. Actually, it could be for people with like severe, you know, problems, and they actually rebound and recover, and they don't need hospice anymore. I've actually known people like that. They had hospice care and they got out of hospice care. So it's not always about that, but yeah. That case was, it's really interesting to read about. And if you're a teacher, or if you're anybody who's going through any of these ethical cases with your students, the textbooks that I've seen don't cover this stuff in a lot of detail. And it's not a slam against any of the textbook companies and stuff out there, just because I feel like I have to put the education thing out there. But like, if you just do a case study on this and like look up what Bradley was saying, like Karen Quinlan, I think that'd be an interesting case study for them to get some history behind that.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to when I was in grad school, the Terry Schiavo case was a pivotal case.
Yes, I remember that. That was a huge deal. I remember that was all over talk radio. I used to listen to talk radio, and Michael Savage is the guy I listened to. And he would go off. I mean, this was for weeks and weeks. And I didn't, you know, I was an EMS at the time, but I was like, yeah, this doesn't really impact me, because I really wasn't that cognizant, because I was 20, 21 years old at the time. So I didn't really think much about it. Now, looking back on it, I'm like, oh, crap, I missed like a huge moment in ethical stuff. And I was listening to it on talk radio, and it had everybody in the country up in arms about that.
Right. So I had, you know, I had Dr. Giles and Dr. Hyde. We used to call them Jekyll and Hyde. So, you know, and we talked at length about the Terry Schiavo case, because, you know, unfortunately, you know, it was February 25th of 1990. She was 26 years old and went into cardiac arrest at her home in St. Petersburg, Florida. And while she was successfully resuscitated, she had massive brain damage due to lack of oxygen to her brain. And so the whole time, you know, after that, after 2.5 months without improvement, her diagnosis was changed to that of a persistent vegetative state. And then for 2 years, they attempted, you know, occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy, you know, everything they could to return to some state of awareness. So her husband, basically looked at and said, you know, he didn't really want to prolong her life without the support, you know, or the prospect of recovery. And in 1998, he elected to remove her feeding tube. But of course, that was stopped because her parents disputed the, you know, his assertions and challenged him. And they said, we're going to challenge her medical diagnosis. And they argued in favor of continuing that. And then, you know, it's highly publicized till 2005 when the feeding tube was actually removed.
Yeah, that was, and I remember that was a big challenge that George Bush Jr., George Bush had, right? That was a huge ethical thing with the Republicans and the conservatives on that. It's like, well, and that was the big thing. It was the right to life. It was the protecting the sanctity of life. But everybody in the medical community is thinking, yeah, but we're also, you know, we're prolonging, I guess, what everybody was saying, like the inevitable for these people.
Yeah. So, I remember, you know, President W. Bush actually cutting his vacation short, and it was something, you know, it went in front of Congress and they passed something at like 12:45 at night. And, you know, he knew it was going to pass. So he had already started his flight back. And at 1:15 or 1 something in the morning, he was there to sign the bill into law. So, you know, he felt that strong about that pivotal case.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. Like, this is if you want to go in a rabbit hole. So that's two cases. And you can talk about the Terry Schiavo case for an entire episode in and of itself, dispute on the condition and all that stuff. But if you really wanted to go into rabbit holes, which I know a lot of people do, you start looking up people who wake up after comas. So that's the other end of that argument Like, did you ever hear of this guy's name was Martin Pistorius, the guy who woke up after 12 years and was aware?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we have to remember, sad cases like that are the exception and not the rule. And I think that's where people get a little flustered.
Right. So there are a couple of things. Differences in those cases. When you start looking at the brain and the neurons, I'm not going to go into CTs and everything else, but when you start to see things liquefy, because the neural components or the neurons are no longer making connections, no longer functional, and they die, they begin to liquefy. And you can definitely see that deterioration, you know, same with stroke patients on a CT.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what they were seeing on her CTs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. See, and you know, more in-depth stuff than even I did. I've gotten exposure to Terry Schiavo only through what I remember from her and maybe from a couple articles I read. But there's always more to the story. Like, I think that's another thing about EMS and anything we talk about in general. We're hitting the salient features, the bullet points. There's so many details that you could go in. You may find out, oh, that's why this happened. Like, I didn't know that about that they did these tests and were like, no, there's no coming back.
Right. And you know, that's why we've got to combine science with communication, with family care and integration, with all of that. But so let's take the Terry Schiavo case. Let's expand on it just a little bit without talking about the case specifically. Let's talk about EMS and having to make split-second decisions and things like that. So the American Heart Association estimates that somewhere in the neighborhood of about 350 to 400,000 people suffer cardiac arrest each year. Well, there was a study from the Netherlands that shows about 18.6% of patients over the age of 70 made it out of the hospital after suffering cardiac arrest. Well, there again, that's a small percentage that gets resuscitated. Because especially after the age of 70, which is, I want to say somewhere around 2%. And then, you know, this percentage, you know, kind of grows smaller as they age, with only about like 11.6% of those that get resuscitated that survive after the age of 90, you know. So without CPR, we know the chances of spontaneous circulation are less than 40%. And most patients that have had these discussions will have a, you know, what we call a post form or a most form. Those are advanced directives. They'll have a DNR or they'll have a living will. But for those patients that don't have that, and we get the medical history of, hey, this patient's in stage 3 or stage 4 cancer, why do we continue those resuscitative efforts knowing that these patients are probably going to live, if they're resuscitated, in a persistent vegetative state?
Honestly, I think the easy thing happens. I think the leg, this isn't what I think, this is what I know just from hearing and being around EMS for all these years, is it's a lot easier to do something and defend that. That's what they keep hearing. Like, well, you know what? If I don't do anything, I'm more liable. So that tells me that the legal framework for the agency they work for is weak or trepid at most, if they're just willing to hang out their EMS professionals and not give them any sort of backing, any guidance in some of these weird scenarios that we know is going to come up. It may only happen once every few years for every provider, but every paramedic is going to have to make that decision at some point if you've been in this field for longer than a year.
So I always default to first do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
So the default is resuscitate. Get information. And then we need to have that discussion with the family.
Yes.
The problem is we never teach our personnel or our students, for those of us that are instructors, how to have those conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Nelson, who's a physician at Wake Forest, does a wonderful job with a class he calls acute grief life support. and he goes through how to talk to people and everything else. You know, maybe we can get him on here one day and we'll go through that.
That'd be awesome.
But the whole thing is most of these patients are going to have an advanced directive, a DNR or a living will. So that's kind of what I wanted to focus on for this session. So what is the difference between a DNR, advanced directive, and a living will?
So I'll tell you what, how I used to teach it. Now, the DNR, it was almost as like a joke because you'd have people with tattoos and different things say DNR and stuff on it. Advanced directives, I actually had my students fill out a Google survey that I created. You can create those for free. I had them all fill out a pulse chart. Like, hey, if something bad happens to you, do you want IV therapy? Do you want drugs? Do you want dialysis, surgeries, things like that? And that kind of got them to explore that side of medicine. And these are brand new EMT students, by the way. And I thought it was really interesting. And the results, I'll tell you what I got from the results after you do your talk, because I want to share them with you. I think you'd find that pretty interesting. But that's how I used to teach it was advanced directives is literally they're giving you stuff to do in the future. DNR is they're giving you something to do like right now.
Right. So we'll talk a little bit about DNRs, but you know, DNR do not resuscitate. The other part of that is that I want to make sure people understand is it's not a do not care. Mm-hmm. You still need to provide comfort care, pain relief, and everything else.
Yes.
So go ahead and say what you were going to say about your.
So what's interesting is, okay, so we did the physician order of life-sustaining treatments. Basically, it was basic stuff like pain management, IV fluids for blood pressure support. And then it went down to like simple surgeries, dialysis, and I can't remember what the other ones were. Oh, yeah, prolonged time on the intubated, on the mechanical ventilator. And I would do this at the beginning of a semester when I knew my EMT students didn't know much about medicine. And it was interesting because most of the students wanted most of the interventions. However, there was this NPR report that came, I don't remember, I think it was back in 2014, 2015. I remember, I think the lady's name was Catherine Hobson. I think it was. Anyways, they basically had this cohort of physicians and they filled out the pulse, what they would want in pulse. I was floored. I couldn't believe it. The physicians, by and large, all chose the same thing. Pain management only. Nothing else.
Wow.
I was like, and I would show that to my students and I'd have both graphs comparing them. I said, isn't that interesting? Now, this isn't something that you should cite and that you should go into research unless you want to do the research and stuff for it. You're more than welcome to. I thought it was rather interesting, though, that this spoke more to the advanced directives and that physicians didn't want that stuff. They didn't want simple surgeries and dialysis and being on a ventilator. Most of the physicians, now, I don't know how it was put to them or anything, but they're physicians. They ought to know how the pulse works or most. But they mostly just wanted pain meds. One doctor chose not to get pain meds out of that entire cohort. And the students were they would always be kind of floored with it, going, wow, I would expect doctors would want everything. And I was like, yeah, I would too. But it's interesting because we're forcing this care onto everyone else, yet the people who are doing that care don't seem to want it. Now, that's just off of one study, so we got to be really careful about how we extrapolate that to wider audiences. And that was, you know, close to a decade ago, too.
So it's funny that you say that, you know, because part of my living will says, you know, I don't want to be on a ventilator for an extended period of time, you know, everything else. So I guess I pretty much take the same view, you know, ease my pain, let me go. Mm-hmm. So do not resuscitate me. I guess is the way that I look at it. Because, I mean, if you're going to resuscitate me to send me to a nursing home to drool on a napkin, that is not what I want.
Oh yeah. We had to make the decision with my granddad about that. Like he was in a very bad condition, lots of IVs. The doctor came out and talked to us and said, here's the chances of him coming back. But if he comes back, he's going to be on dialysis. He's probably going to be in a nursing home and all that stuff. And we kind of came together as a family. We're like, he would kill us. Like, he would murder us if he found, if we did this to him. There's no way we can do that. And so we got to make the decision as a family. And here's the interesting thing. I've never heard this before. The physician afterwards, after we made the decision and everything, the doctors, he almost like let his guard down so he could be a human and said, hey, just letting you know, I would have done the exact same thing if this were my granddad. And I talked to him afterwards. I said, why didn't you say that? He goes, I'm not allowed to. I can't convince you of what you're supposed to do ethically for your own family member. I can just tell you what I can do with mine, but I would have to do it after the fact. He said, I'm not really, that's not how we're trained. We're trained to give you the information and the guidance. It's ultimately your decision as to how you're going to follow it. And so I think if we ignore as a profession, especially since we are going to be dealing with an older population, we have a younger population that's coming up and dealing with way more older than outnumber us by quite a bit, that these are conversations and education points that we have to start having.
Well, absolutely. Because, you know, right now is 2021, and between 2025 and 2030, we will see the gray panthers emerging. So the silver tsunami is coming.
Yes. Yes.
And I say that with great love, because I have some friends that fall into that category.
Yeah.
But you know, we've really got to be in tune with this because of, you know, the peace, love, and rock and roll that happened in the late 70s, early 80s is now getting ready to hit the age range where we're going to have a lot of these decisions, a lot of stuff that we're really going to have to look at. And that's our parents or my parents' generation.
Yeah. And not to mention the community care paramedics out there who may be the ones who are the front line of dealing with stuff like that.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about DNR. You know, and some of these individuals, depending on you know, their position, you know, financially and within their community and their family, they may have living wills.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we have ever in pre-hospital education done justice talking about what a living will is. We always tell people, you know, you can't use a living will, this, that, and the other. Well, really, it depends. So a living will can be used to guide care, typically done in a facility setting.
Right, yeah.
So the reason EMS has typically not used them, you know, a lot of people say, can EMS acknowledge a living will or life prolonging, you know, procedure document? Well, the answer is it depends. And I say that the way I guess Wes would say it from a legal standpoint is, but yeah. Generally no, because it's your responsibility to be familiar with the local protocol, but the reason we typically educate and tell, you know, pre-hospital students that we don't honor living wills is because it's a legal document that we don't have time to read and go through.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a one sheet that says bullet pointed words. It's a huge legal with a lot of legalese in it too.
I'd have to look at mine. I want to say my living will is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 14 pages. You know, I would want somebody who's standing here over me, you know, trying to make the decision, reading through 14 pages of BS to get to the last bullet points to go, oh yeah, he didn't want anything.
Yeah, it turns out he didn't want any oxygen at all. You can cut that off.
So
he wanted to be smothered with a pillow. That's weird. All right, go for it.
So that takes us to advanced directives. So, you know, those are legal documents as well, but, you know, whether they're, you know, post or pulsed forms or most forms, it depends on what jurisdiction you're in. So it's a physician order for scope of treatment or medical order for scope of treatment. You know, it depends on who issues it, whether it's a nurse practitioner, PA, physician. That allows the individual and their family to express their wishes for healthcare. And it's bullet pointed, you know, and they're very useful because it addresses not only the code status, but a variety of other treatment categories. Yeah. Pain management, maybe they want, you know, assisted ventilations or oxygen, but they don't want to be intubated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe they want, you know, antibiotics and fluid resuscitation, but they don't want, you know, extraordinary measures with other things. Mm-hmm. So it's easily recognizable. And a lot of these are actually pink in color. What do y'all have in Tennessee?
They're pink. Yeah, it's the same. It's the same color. Yeah.
So you know, the goldenrod or the DNR forms and the pulse or most forms are pink in color. So they're easily recognizable. And, you know, it's been a couple of months, but, you know, I ran a college gentleman who had stage 4 cancer. He was in agonal respiration when we got there, laying in the bed. You know, there was some question about what to do and everything else. So I told my partner, I said, you know, pull him down, let's open his airway, let's oxygenate him, ventilate him. Went and talked to the family a little bit. They didn't have a form readily available, but we were eventually able to find something and get medical control on the phone. Basically, we started an IV and provided pain management and comfort basically for the next, you know, hour and 20 minutes until the gentleman, you know, died. So, mm-hmm. you know, that was his wishes.
Yeah.
You know? So.
And as long as you have medical control, I think that's a big thing, is that's your other cover that you can have at your live cover that can be like, yeah, we also signed off on this as well. So it makes sense, you know, from that standpoint too.
Yeah, and where I work part-time, you know, the medical director is really big on comfort care, comfort measures for end-of-life care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she is a great emergency physician, and she really understands. So, you know, that gives us a little bit of leeway with that. And fortunately, being able to talk to her and tell her what we had, she was like, yeah, I think you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So the difference between the two is, you know, the most form, the pulse form, you know, whatever it's called, gives you the information so you can assist that patient with whatever specific things that they wanted versus actual resuscitation.
Yeah. And yeah, that was the thing that, because you can have somebody with a DNR and a pulse form, like, in an, you know, somebody who goes to cardiac arrest and be like, well, here's the pulse form. I'll hold on. Let me go get the DNR. And generally you have some outline stuff on there, but there's major qualifications to like a valid DNR and a valid pulse form.
Right. And, you know, you should be familiar with whatever your jurisdiction recognizes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the same time, there's also going to be those cases where does it fit?
Yeah. And that's the best, that's the cases where we just don't get paid enough in our field, because you're making crazy bad decisions. That it's bad for everybody involved. It's bad for the doc. It's bad for us. I mean, we just don't know the best decisions. And so you have square peg, round hole situation where, you're like, oh, they have a DNR, but we can't locate it right now. And you know, this guy's like 92 years old. And you're like, oh crap, do I do compressions on him? I mean, we have pit crew CPR. So I'm technically supposed to do this for 20 minutes. And if I delay any further, I'm going to get in trouble now for delaying care for this guy while they're trying to get a DNR that may or may not exist.
Yeah. So let me give you a scenario. Let's talk about it. So you're called to the home of a 72-year-old male who's fallen out of bed. He's non-responsive. He's in agonal respirations. Wife tells you he's got terminal cancer. And she says, here's his most form that indicates he's a DNR and wants comfort measures only. She basically says, hey, can you lift him back in the bed? She doesn't want him transported to the hospital. What do you do?
Okay, so I've been in these situations before, sadly. We live in a smaller community, and I work in a smaller community. The first thing I'm going to do is ask her to please go try to locate that DNR form. I'm going to get him back into the bed. Call medical control, call the doc in the ER immediately. Start at least putting stuff on the patient, because at the end of the day, if the physician doesn't feel comfortable with that decision based on the information they're given, they may be like, hey, you know, if you got to go off your protocol, but you have family there, you have a pulse form, I'd want to look at that pulse form. All this is taking a lot of time. I mean, what I've just covered is anywhere between 3.5 to 5 minutes of time. And that's time you're not compressing, not ventilating. And we just went over all that information with Tom last week in that podcast. So this is one of those bad situations where, you know, it wouldn't be a good national registry question. Like, I wouldn't put that on a registry question. But I like the idea of, let's help her. Let's see. She said he's got terminal cancer. We got the physician or life-sustaining treatment. Let's at least do an assessment on this person. Get on the phone with supervisor. Get on the phone with medical control. Talk to the wife. See if she can produce that DNR. Things get hairy if she cannot produce the DNR, though.
Right. So let's say that she's got it. You talk to medical control. They say, all right, give him some pain medication. Make him more comfortable. You put him back in bed. You're going to stay monitoring for a little bit. That's just the right thing to do.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do that. That's a consistent behavior. We do it in assisted living, maybe not assisted living facilities. But yeah, they do it at these homes. I think it is appropriate. That's how this lady wants them to go. We'll sit with them for 30, 45 minutes, whatever it takes. And then, you know, get your local resources on board and then kind of coach her through what's happening, though, because even though, and I know you've seen this too, even though they sign everything, they have the pulse, they have the DNR, but when it comes time for it to happen, that's when all that stuff kind of like starts to become questioned. It's like, wait, actually, ooh, I don't know if we really want this to happen this way or not.
Right. So let's spin this one just a little bit. So now you're on the scene of an automobile accident, and you've got a 68-year-old male who's unresponsive. He's sustained life-threatening injuries. His son, who's the driver of the vehicle, tells you, hey, my dad's got an advanced directive. He presents the form to you. He says that he would like this followed. So you note in one section that he's chosen to be a DNR, but the next session, he's chosen comfort measures only. So what do you do?
Okay, I know exactly what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna load this dude up. He's not dead yet. He's still gonna get good care. I'm still gonna get him secured properly, get an IV, and I'm gonna need to consult with medical control. You know, probably sooner rather than later, because if he does have life threatening injuries. In trauma, you know, and everybody probably listening to this knows, it's not going to be very long before he goes into cardiac arrest. And you do not want to wait until the last minute to call and say, oh, by the way, this guy's a DNR.
Right. So some people are probably going, you know, why would you ask that question? You know, why would you put that scenario out there? Well, because it can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it probably doesn't happen that often. But, you know, this guy took his dad out for one last hurrah.
I think we should do sand table planning. You know, what we used to do in the Army is like, you plan for stuff, you plan for the inevitable. You don't plan for the 90% of cases, you plan for the 5% of the cases.
Right.
It makes the most sense. I mean, like, that's like if you're going to a PALS call, you know, a critical kid call. You don't plan for, oh, they should be fine. They'll probably be okay. They probably just need some Tylenol and they'll be okay. No, you plan for the worst and hope that's the best thing could happen. So, it's funny. Every single time I feel like we say something like this, somebody will probably leave a comment going, hey, you guys said this. And literally I had a case like this happen not that long ago or like right after the podcast. So to me, it's not out of the, I don't think it's out of the blue at all.
So yeah, I've got one more for you.
Okay.
So you're called to a local restaurant for a 58-year-old female who's choking. Mm-hmm. You arrive. Her friend states that the patient has an advanced directive in her purse. She's now in respiratory arrest. She finds the form, she hands it to you, and that she's chosen DNR and comfort measures only. What do you do?
Oh, I'd still try to clear the choking hazard. I mean, if she's not in cardiac arrest just yet, I mean, the advanced directive is only going to give for, that means she had some pre-existing condition. This is an acute situation that probably has nothing to do with her pre-existing condition. So, I mean, you can't, that doesn't override the acute emergency right now. That would be like if she has, let's say she's in anaphylaxis because she ate something with peanuts in it, but she has a post for congestive heart failure. Well, I'm going to treat the anaphylaxis. I'm going to treat the upper respiratory problem first. Now, if she goes into cardiac arrest, that's when the DNR and the local protocols kick into place, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, the post, the DNR is for whatever that chronic condition is, not for the acute condition that the patient's experiencing when they're out like this. So, so I agree with you. So, you know, those are just some things I wanted to throw out there since we've talked about DNR, advanced directives, and living wills. But all of that came from a butterfly.
That's awesome. And it's funny when you said that because my kids brought in butterfly wings. They found some weird butterfly wings. I don't know. There must be something happening to our butterflies because we just found intact butterfly wings on the ground. And they were like preserving them with napkins and stuff. And then one of them failed and the dog ate it. I'm like, oh, that's sad. So I was like, huh, wonder what weird place this twist that Bradley's going to have for butterflies. So it was a lot better than what I was thinking. But this is a good conversation. And I think it's a good conversation to have with students, with especially new paramedics. If you're a new paramedic and you have not gone through some type of formal training or training with a good older preceptor or officer or supervisor or something like that, you need to do it because you don't want to wait until, you know, your first call to be struck with that, I think.
No, I agree. I mean, we really need to have these conversations with our personnel, with our students, and physicians, healthcare providers, community paramedics need to have this conversation with their patients.
Yeah, absolutely. There needs to be streamlined. And also, I think it's good to have a conversation with the physicians in the ER too, so they kind of know. A lot of times there's a huge disconnect between the clinical and the pre-hospital. And a lot of times we don't recognize that until the gaps are exposed. And we didn't bring this up, and I don't want to bring this up too much because I know we're getting towards the end, but like, we also live not only in a heavy litigious society, we always have been, but we also live in a heavy social media world where we're being recorded for all the actions that we do. Yeah. So I'm not saying the 92-year-old dude who is in cardiac arrest on the ground is going to have his grandkids YouTubing you and stuff, but there could be some weird situations that put you in very uncomfortable, precarious situations. So I think it's good to like recognize those beforehand, sand table the discussion your medical director and your ER and your physicians and things like that, so that y'all can get a plan to go and not just be, so you're being responsive and not reactionary.
Absolutely. Awesome. So, you know, and plan for yourselves. Know what you want.
Yes. Yes. If anything else. Yeah. If anybody gets anything else from this, it's like, put that stuff down on paper somewhere. Doesn't cost a whole lot of money. In fact, I'm sure there's like free websites out there that will let you print off all sorts of stuff. You just got to go get it signed, or at least think about it. Put your wishes somewhere that somebody has access to it, so that your family isn't left making terribly bad decisions that they're not sure if you wanted them to make or not. No, this has been good.
Right.
Do you have any final thoughts? I feel like it's been a final thought time anyways. At least I had mine.
So the only final thought I would say is, if you want to learn more about either of the two cases, I would encourage you that we talked about. And My Sorrow is probably one of the best books I ever read, that talks about the struggle that Karen Ann's mother wrote.
Okay. My Sorrow. All right. Awesome. I'll try to link that in our show notes, which you should look at on our website. They're also in the YouTube video that you can get to as well. It's nice to have resources and stuff out there, because there's plenty of good resources out there. Well, that ends tonight's episode of the EMS Handoff. Again, thank you for, listening, entertaining us. On behalf of Bradley and me and David, who is away, but we'll be back with us shortly. We just ask that you stay safe and always remember the value of your EMS Handoff.